Hello and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm Bill Barton, a solicitor who lives and breathes construction and engineering law. At Barton Legal, we help clients in the UK and around the world on everything from litigation and arbitration to drafting and negotiating contracts. And in this podcast, we unpack the latest legal trends and problems facing the industry, providing you with straight-talking insights to help break down these complex legal questions. So, let's get on with today's episode. Hello everybody, I'm Bill Barton from Barton Legal, and this is another episode of the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm joined today by none other than Nick Child of Secretariat. I should say of Secretariat, but he has so many different hats. I'm just speaking to Nick. I can't believe he's never been on a podcast because, well, frankly, I just can't believe he hasn't had a queue of people lining up to talk to him about all the various things that he has done and does. And I can't believe that anybody within the construction engineering industry, broader sort of law disputes, doesn't know or heard of Nick. But for those of you who have stumbled somehow on this great podcast series, tell your friends. Nick, can you introduce yourself in sort of a minute or so? And you can introduce any part of you, because you're a bit like a Rubik's Cube. I think you can assemble it, and then you've got so many different sides and colours and parts. And
if only I was as smart as a Rubik's Cube.
I think you are.
I am Nick Child. I am a managing director at Secretariat, which is a disputes consultancy that is now global. I have five wonderful children. I am a very keen golfer. I'm not as good as I am keen, but you know. In 2009, I had a really terrible idea to do some sort of battle of the bands among law firms, which then kind of took off a bit. I am a founding trustee of the J. Lemon Foundation, and I am a lifetime ambassador to Kids Out. Is that a minute? I don't know.
Oh, it's about that. Well, you've touched on some of the things, and when you do podcasts, I've found that I explain to people, I don't give the people I'm talking to any pre-questions, because to me it's just about having a chat. I say to the guests, I'm not going to go into your private life, and you find that actually one of the hardest things is not sounding like you're just having a massive suck-up session with your guest. And with you, Nick, it's particularly difficult because you sort of glibly, oh, yeah, I had this idea in 2009, these sort of bands. So for the benefit, how many millions has Law Rocks now raised? And if you want to divide it, or put globally or UK, America, Middle East?
Globally, it's currently $9 million, or a bit over. But we hope to go past $10 million before the year is out, because we're still quite early in the year. When it comes to how we stage our gigs, we have quite a lot in quarters three and four.
So my point is, how many of you listening have ever raised $9 million? I mean, you have to just sort of say $9 million. And that's just one thing, okay? I'll come back to Law Rocks because I know time flies. Let's go back to a charity, because you have a family history of charity, don't you?
I do.
So the charity that your father formed?
Yeah, so my late father and his very best friend formed, had an idea in the early 80s to enable disadvantaged children, be that they were physically or mentally, I'm not sure if I can say disabled anymore, but that was what it was called then, and underprivileged kids, to enjoy a day out, just a day out, without them having to suffer pointing, queuing a theme park, etc., etc. So they arranged with Lady Grantchester, who was the Littlewoods, to get Thorpe Park closed for the day. And I forget how many hundreds of children on the first one enjoyed that, but they had a theme park to themselves, which gave them an experience that every other child in the UK sort of took as normal. that has subsequently grown to, I think, the largest children's charity in the UK. We work with every single women's refuge in the UK. When mum appears at a refuge in the dead of night with two kids under her arm, within 24 hours, each child gets an age-appropriate box of new clothes, books, toys. Every child in refuge gets the same at Christmas. We took, I think this year, 37,000 kids had a day out on Kids Out. We have a very, very light admin side.
So yeah, it's very efficient.
Our admin spend is very low, and the people that work there are completely committed. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, so people will be able to date this podcast because we have the Kids Out dinner at the Royal Lancaster this Thursday, where I'll be attending, and it's sports, and basically it's a brilliant way of fundraising. I also take part in the one in Leeds, and they are truly amazing events. We had a woman who spoke at the one at Leeds, and it's incredibly moving when you're listening to the impact on a woman who's had to leave home and children. It just sounds like a massive suck up, but it's really hard not to just constantly. Well, I mean, the proverbial hat hardly sits on my head when I'm with you, because you do so much, and people see you out doing things, and you're always getting other people to do things, and I think that is an amazing skill. I don't want you to big yourself up or be modest. You've always had an ability. I met you 30 odd years ago when you at Keating. What would you say was the catalyst for you being such an incredible people person?
Very simple answer, my father. My father was the man that knew everyone and instilled on my brother and I. Neither of us went to university, much to my father's disappointment. But my father instilled on us that it's not what you know, it's who you know. And he was very successful. He kept pointing out to us the value in people, and would often tell us, there is nothing more interesting in life than the people in it. And I still swear by that. The fact is that I've been in this industry, in construction law and international arbitration, for a very long time now. And you make a lot of friends along the way, you being a case in point. It's about the relationships that you forge. I was very lucky that my long clerking career meant that a lot of my relationships were built on trust, which is very different from having them being built on sales.
Yes.
Because no one ever assumes I'm going to try and sell them something. But with my professional hat on, in every client meeting I have, and as you know, a client meeting, when we have a client meeting, it's a very nice bottle of wine on our dining floor here at 22 Bishopsgate. It's important that people leave a meeting with me being a little bit better off than they were before they walked in. By no means gossip, none of that, but more intelligence, the prospect of an introduction, the prospect of a new connection for them to take forward. If we all did that, imagine what an exciting world it would be.
That's a really, really good point, because in all the time I've known you, you've always been very generous in providing help and assistance, advice.
Well, that's very kind.
And you have. And as you say, it's giving without that expectation of giving back. And it's not just advice. I'll give you another example of where... actually makes me very emotional, where you made a massive difference when I was setting up our business, so 18 years ago.
Jeez, that's flown.
I know. None of my family or friends thought it was a good idea. Every single one of them basically said I was a lunatic. And two of the only people who, there were some others, but two notables, you know, David Barnes and you. And you were so supportive. I knew you reasonably well back then through work, but you were so supportive and encouraging that it gave me a real belief. You gave me the belief that I could actually do that and survive. And it was such an amazing thing to see somebody in law really giving. And there was absolutely nothing in it for you. And that was such a lovely thing.
There was, because we still have our friendship.
You've done that all the way. When you were clerking, when you were coming up through the clerk, and I have to say, wherever your father is, whatever people's beliefs, I can only believe he's just like blown away with being proud by what you do and what you've done. When you were coming up clerking, what did you sort of think? You know, I'm interested in the question. If you went back 30 years, what did you think you'd be doing? And if you look back now, if you imagine that you're that early clerk, do you look back now and think, shit, like, whoa, you know, how, do you see what I mean?
It's an interesting one. And any clerks listening to this will no doubt have a bell ringing in their head when they hear this. When you are on that journey, you cannot ever consider doing anything but that, at least back then. So how long have I been out? 11 years, maybe? And I did 22 at Keating and then another 3 at the Chancery set prior to that. And no one ever leaves. Back then, no one ever left clerking. You stayed a clerk.
Yeah.
And you would retire as a clerk or be fired as a clerk and then have to go and do something else. I looked at the generation of senior clerks above me, the generation older than me, and I thought, I don't want to retire like that. That's not what I want to do. But of course, at the time, there weren't any other options, so I was head down. I did have some remarkable colleagues who, many of whom are still at Keating, quite a lot of them do what I do now, and some wonderfully supportive barristers that I worked with over the years that kind of made life bearable. So I can remember one instance where one sort of senior junior was thinking, well, you know, what should we do now with my career? He was really, really engaging and wanted to hear what I thought, which the relationship between clerk and barrister back then wasn't always like that. Yeah. And I said, well, you know, you've conquered this market, you've conquered that market, come to career with me and we'll do that. And we did. And he did an awful lot of very fancy cases from that part of the world, which then, of course, introduced that work to the other members of Keating, who are still, as far as I know, doing very well out of that market. So it's, yeah, it was, I never envisaged this. I never thought I would be doing what I do now. But I have to acknowledge the fact that clerking and that world and everyone in it gave me the, I guess, the ability to actually do this. So for everyone I've worked with and alongside, I'm extremely grateful, with a few caveats, but...
Yeah, well, we'll have a few caveats. But, and you had... It was an era, wasn't it? I think you're right in that there were some really big names. You know, I met, you know, late Paul Darling when he was with you. There were some really big names in construction back then, some of whom KCs, some who moved into the judiciary. But it was a time of characters, wasn't it, and forming and the industry changing.
It was, and the construction bar was a lot smaller then, a lot smaller. There were two back then there were two major sets and some other chambers that had cells of barristers and silks that that were very good at construction. Now there are arguably five sets and an ever-increasing amount of chambers who have those cells, because it's interesting work. It is about the built environment. It's the world around us.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's profitable. There's so, I mean, I'm always, well, I suppose I'm not surprised, because it happens on a regular basis, but you see another name, another council's chambers, and they've got people who are doing construction. I'm thinking, I've never heard of them, you know, and then you look them up, and as you say, they've got two or three. And it's the same in law firms. You know, 18 years ago, there were a lot of all the major practices, you know, had construction engineering.
Yeah.
But there wasn't the plethora that there now is across, you know, dozens and dozens of law firms.
Well, if you think as well about the amount of, back in the day, there were two boutique construction law firms in the UK. Two. There's maybe seven now, you included.
Thank you very much.
And I think clients like that. Clients like people that only do one thing, because they go to them specifically for the issue that they have, and they're not paying for anyone's learning curve, which is a huge comfort.
And I think that's an area where law firms still have to have a great deal to learn from barristers' chambers, because law firms historically set out, and in a lot of places outside of the UK, it's actually still the same. People are generalists rather than specialists. But in the UK, that specialism, when we set up, we did a huge amount of white labelling for other law firms. So, you know, we'd do the work to explain to people, do the work, but it would be on blank paper, wouldn't have our details on. We'd give it to the firm that had instructed, and they would give it to their clients as if it were their own. And they were very nervous about saying to their client, oh, actually, we don't do construction. Now, that's much, much less so. And you're right. People see the benefit of specialisms. And the degree, I mean, even if you look at the degree of specialism within the bar, just in construction.
Yeah. When you break it down, there are people that have huge experience of either wind farm. You know, there are a group of barristers that if you have a huge wind farm dispute, you go to that pool of people. Likewise with LNG stuff. Likewise with, I don't know, mechanical failure or turbines. Everyone has, so many people have a lot of experience in specific fields, but that's due to the amount of time the construction law has now been going. When I started at Keating, which was then 10 Essex Street, bless him, Donald Keating was obviously still alive. A lovely, lovely man he was. It's just so brilliant. But construction law was still relatively new then. And dare I say it, expert witnesses were something that no one had ever heard of.
No.
Certainly not in a professional capacity. So, yeah, it's evolved hugely, and look how it's grown globally. It is truly a global industry. And where I feel what you might call pure commercial disputes world used to look down their nose at it a bit, that is no longer true.
No, I say that. I think there's a great deal of envy, actually, towards construction engineering dispute. Probably the only area of dispute where they still might look down their nose at us is international treaty. But even that is connected, you know, where the sums in dispute and fees are phenomenal.
We do an awful lot of investment treaty work here, as you know.
As experts.
Some of the biggest ones in recent years. I'll tell you a secret. Among all the secretariat managing directors, the most interesting ones, and I've witnessed all my colleagues doing this at them when they're talking about what they do, is our engineering sciences guys. The guys that can tell you exactly why one bolt that was defective brought down an entire power station, had to be turned off, which, as you know, is a 4 or 5 day process. So you've got 5 days loss of power there, output. Then you've got to fix it. But then going forwards, often the case is when you've had a faulty power station, the rules, I guess, are that you then have to take it down more often to make sure that doesn't happen again and sort of keep checking it. So what to the owner was a huge, huge moneymaker actually turns out to be a bit of a pain and less of a moneymaker.
Secretary just taken on a engineering.
We have, yeah. Team, our newest one, our newest guy, Sam, is an expert in batteries, the kind you find in cars. He's also an expert in why they, or how they combust, why they combust, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that's given in the news today, I read that more people are buying ground source heat pumps and electric cars than ever in the UK. I don't know if you saw, there was a boat that caught fire that was full of electric cars because one of the electric cars caught fire. It's such a hugely growing market that his level of expertise is going to be ever more important.
And it must be exciting for you as MD at Secretariat to be growing your business in these new areas, because you were a very, you know, you were one of the early people to move out from clerking into consultancy, and you're still.
Well, lots of people think I was the first. I was actually the second. There was one other guy who's still on this side of the fence who left like a year before me, but had a slightly different role. I walked into Navigant with what was Navigant. You know, I saw parity with all the senior people there, and used to sit in some very big fancy meetings around the world. Again, the people, you know, the CEO from those days, Dewey Howard, still a very dear friend, still see her whenever we're in the same city. That gave me a real shock. Leaving Chambers, where I was someone in a building full of 70 people, to going into a 6,000 person, $1 billion publicly traded corporation. That's a bit of a shock, and my instructions were, I said, well, what exactly do you want me to do? And my then boss, who was based in Chicago, said, well, just do what you do. I'm not even sure what that is, but I think I can do it.
I think you've been doing it, because one of the things you seem to have achieved with Navigant and morphing Secretariat is you have a very cohesive appearance. I say that because there are a number of consultancies where they don't appear globally linked. You know, they can be very big, but they're very disjointed.
One other thing is you know, you've met a lot of my colleagues, and you have known some of them for a very long time. I think the main thing about Secretariat is the culture. We have a very, very flat hierarchical system. We involve everyone in everything, and essentially, it is a bunch of friends working together. You know, Don Harvey, the founder, one of the five founding fathers, but the sort of main founder, and I used to talk about when and not if, way back when I was a Keating.
Right.
Because I was just in awe of, back then they were 30 people, but I was in awe of the way they operated, the collegiate nature. Everyone I met was just brilliant. And then when Natasha and I joined, when we were 50, and now we're 7.5 years later, we've just gone past 650. But they're all the right people. We've been really, really careful at every stage to make sure we get it right. And a lot of the people we've worked with before or we've known in industry before, when we had our MD retreat last year, it was a whole bunch of friends who have the same title or who all work at the same firm. But it was really, really lovely and non-instructive. No one told us what we should be doing. It was all about input and sharing ideas. And
I think that's very unusual in the corporate world these days.
It is. But that was always Don's way. And that's what we all do, because that's what he wants us to do. And it really works. As you know yourself, if you choose the right people, work becomes a complete pleasure.
Mm.
Everyone I'm surrounded by, even just in this office, I'm in awe of their intelligence and their talent and the things they achieve for their clients in the witness box. I won't chat him out because he's sat through this glass wall here. But one of my colleagues, one of the leading international arbitration lawyers ever, always told me that the difference between winning and losing a case was having him.
Right.
It's Travis Taylor, but don't tell him.
But I think experts, I love having technical experts, because as you say, I get blown away by that thought of that, it's that bolt. Or when you, I love bridges, but when you see something that has been constructed, and frequently because of the nature of the disputes, we're less involved sometimes with the with their construction. I mean, I do a lot of non-contentious, but you don't tend to be on site when the thing's being built. You're dealing with the paperwork up front, and you see drawings or pretty impressions. But post-event, you go somewhere, and I'm always struck by going and seeing a structure. If you're saying, whether it's a bridge or a building, and you look at it, the one behind you, and just think, how somebody built that and all the parts in it. And I'm not sure if people in buildings think enough sometimes about the fact that, where are the pipes? Where are all the electrics? You've got aircon. Where's that come from? Lift.
Yeah, why are there speakers when there's no noise? Because it's white noise, because the air conditioning's too quiet and you can't, humans can't operate without white noise.
And then building design. I mean, Bishopgate is a lovely building. I never really know how do they manage to have all those people wandering around with iPads down in the reception area?
Yeah.
You can't move for someone with an iPad.
They are so connected here. It's
I know.
It's absolutely wonderful. It's so efficient.
And you come up and they're super, super friendly. I mean, you come in, you just sort of, coffee, and you're used to going to some coffee shop somewhere, and it's like, you want? And you come here, it's like, hi, whoa. It's like,
excuse me. Yeah, no, it's a wonderful building.
And you've got to, you get to travel a lot with work. So
yes.
Top three places you like going to?
Anywhere in the States, because for the most part, I enjoy nearly every US city in which we have an office, and all those cities I've been to where we don't have an office.
You want one?
Yeah. It's always such a warm welcome, and they as a country and a race do an awful lot of things very, very well indeed.
Yeah.
I would have to say Dubai as well, because I've been going there since 2006. Which makes me slightly unusual, because lots of people weren't going there then.
Mm-hmm.
And Seoul.
Ah.
Seoul, because I have a lot of very dear friends there, and if they're listening to this, they know exactly who they are. Thanks in advance for the golf in November, by the way. I find the pace of it, the history, and the food, it's just a really, really fun place to go visit.
Yeah.
Really,
I love Seoul because, and it's interesting you say, because the pace, it's barking. I love the fact that I struggle with places around the world where everyone stops on a green light and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you can't see a car for like 300 miles, but people just wait. Whereas in Seoul, it's just full on everywhere. And I love the fact that, I was there in December and people have got, they've got these long padded coats, haven't they, and boots. And you look at it and think, well, why would you those coats?
Can't be that cold.
Can't be that cold. But I know Tony Clemson at the British Embassy, and we were talking about this, and he said his mother-in-law bought him one because his wife is Korean. And he said, oh, you know, I can't wear that. It looks a bit odd. He said he put it on and he just basically didn't want to take it off for the next 3 months. And it was just, but it's so, you go to different parts of Seoul and different parts of Korea. It's so different. And I love the contrast you get. As you say, it's great going to different cities. It's, that must be something that fires your sort of imagination and
very much
meeting
so.
Different people.
Yeah, so Natasha and I were in Istanbul last week, and in Helsinki the week before. We're here this week. Next week we go to Croatia for one of our bigger clients' 50th birthdays. He's very kindly invited us to his big house on the coast. Yes.
Haven't been to Helsinki, have been to Croatia.
Helsinki is just amazing. Croatia looks amazing. I've not been, Natasha has, but I'm looking forward to that huge.
Croatia, trip. If you're there in a week or so, it'll be hot.
Yeah,
and again, they
33, I think, which is fine. Yeah. But, as long as they're not playing golf in it, it's fine.
Beautifully. And so when was the first time you played golf? How bad were you? Or were you sort of, you know, I'm not sure about natural, but could you keep the ball vaguely on the fairway for some time?
No.
Or you were really shit?
No, I played like someone that never played golf before. So I essentially got bullied into it because the first golf day we did at Navigant after my arrival was a huge success, but every single person that played guest-wise was a guest of mine, and I wasn't playing. I was driving around in a golf buggy. So, yeah. And so my colleague said that you got to learn to play golf. I ain't got to do anything I don't want to do, but I thought, oh, okay, let's try it. And then, of course, fell head over heels in love with it, and have now played. As of a few weeks' time, I will have played quite a lot of the top 50 golf courses in the world, I think. And I'm playing the number one golf course in the world, mid-July. So, yeah, I find it a wonderful escape. Clients enjoy playing with Tash and I because you really get to know someone a bit better when you're playing golf with them. Hmm? But you're all doing something you enjoy for 4 hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, people like to network with people with whom they have something in common. And the thing in common is you're all playing golf.
Yeah. And I think golf is a great way to communicate with people when you can play in a relaxed way. When you can play and have a laugh and a joke.
Oh, absolutely.
I say to people, I watch people. Some people play. Nothing can be said. But when you cough, or you know, you're chucking teas at someone just as they're teeing off, that's when you know you've got a relationship, because you're just there having a laugh and you're playing golf, and you do get a different level, don't you?
Yeah, and we all, as I said, we all like people with whom we have something in common. For many of us, when you get to a certain age, it's children, unless you're lucky enough to not have any, and. So you find yourself, you know, we know an awful lot about how our kids are doing. I've had dinner with your son. Slightly envious that his level of sarcasm is higher than mine, but that's right. I'm working on that.
We're all in awe of his sarcasm.
Yeah, if you could tell him that I'm working on it, that'd be really kind. And it's sharing information. People don't necessarily want to talk about work when they're networking. They want to get to know you. People don't like lawyers or expert witness consultancy people or waiters or airline pilots. They like decent human beings who happen to be lawyers, expert witness.
But it's hard to get across, though, isn't it?
I know. I think
it's not about selling. It's about knowing people.
I think it's far easier to demonstrate you're a decent human being than it is. To tell someone that you're brilliant at your job. Not least because if you open with, I'm one of the greatest barristers that ever lived, or done, you're going to lose the audience like that. So we impress upon our team here, we have a very strong pastoral care program where we explain to people when they're building their network and they're taking people out for coffee or a glass of wine after work, we don't want an inquiry, we don't want an opportunity, we want a receipt. That's all we want, just a receipt to show that, because that single receipt shows that you are investing in your own network, which if you think back to when we first met, you and I and all our contemporaries, both on your side of the fence and on the Clarking side of the fence, not spent an awful lot of time building their networks, we wouldn't be where we are today.
No.
Simple
and
facts.
And I quite agree. And it's something that I think requires a lot more attention and, you know, fertilizer and water to help it work than it probably did when we were younger, because there's a harder push, I feel, sometimes, and people forget that it is about the person they're meeting, not about, just as you said, selling or anything else.
I mean, people don't like being sold to.
No.
Full stop.
But I also think that people, if you give them the opportunity, there's very few people who don't actually want to help. If you just have to give them the opportunity, don't you? You have to find that element of their brain or their interests where you suddenly touch upon something where they think, oh, I could help, or I could do something. But sometimes you have to go through a number of subjects, don't you, before you get there.
Yeah, and as you know, and as we look around the room on Thursday night, every single table, I think bar one, has been taken by people in our industry in the international arbitration stroke construction field, both chambers, competitors of mine, and law firms. And I believe that every human being has a charitable strain in them. You just need to allow them the opportunity to demonstrate that, as you just said. You need to, it's a very competitive industry, you know, the charity side of things. And you know, things like the Kids Out Christmas Sport, you're offering someone a fun night out, and for all of those males over 50, no dancing, which is obviously a huge plus. And again, Law Rocks, you know, you buy a ticket, you get a great night out with some live music, most of which you know all the words to. But no one's asking you to sponsor them walking up Kilimanjaro to satisfy their own thirst to walk up Kilimanjaro.
It's a totally different approach, because I think in Law Rocks particularly, you go along and as an audience, you know, as a audience participant, we are there taking. You know, we've bought a ticket, which is never much, but we just take. I mean, tell us about why you decided, or what was the sort of the catalyst? Because I've been to quite a few Law Rocks, primarily through IBA, annual conferences, but you hold them over a range of cities, a range of events. What was that first sort of kernel of a, you know, an idea or?
So when I was at Keating, I questioned why people would want to go and have a Michelin star dinner with me or a fancy meal. I'm taking away their evening. Dinner, it for most of us that are fortunate enough to be able to do so, is the one thing we will all have every night. So what was it about eating a particular food that made it so interesting? And I just found that sort of left me feeling a bit flat about it. There wasn't anything special and it was all a bit repetitive. So I started taking clients to gigs, and I would select people from a certain age group to, and then sort of match them with the artist. So I took a whole bunch, you know, when I was late 20s, early 30s, I took a whole bunch of people who were in their early 50s to go and see, or late 40s, to go and see Roger Waters at Earl's Court, when Earl's Court still existed.
Yeah.
We took a whole load of 20-somethings to the Blur reunion in Hyde Park. We saw so many bands, 10cc, madness. But often in smaller venues, just because it was more fun.
Yeah.
The Fratellis, James. It's really, really important band.
Yeah.
But it was still only 40 quid a ticket, and we all had a beer together, maybe went and had a curry afterwards.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, no one ever forgot who took them to that brilliant gig. The relationships that you form through enjoyable stuff like that are, really, really enjoyable. And I was at one gig in the Albert Hall. It was Joe Brown, so Sam Brown's father, the one who looks like he should have been the third Chuckle Brother. And it was his 50th.
Say, so must have been a few.
Yeah.
Well old.
It was his 50th anniversary of being in music. This is in 2008. And so he came on, and I didn't know he can play every sort of horizontal string instrument you can think of brilliantly. And then Chaz and Dave came on, which I don't know if you've ever seen them play live. It was mesmerizing because Chaz or Dave, whichever one it is that plays the piano, never actually looks at the keys. It's all by feel because he has a microphone and he's looking at the crowd, singing to the people. It's fascinating. Then Sting came on, then Eric Clapton came on, then the lead singer from Dr. Hook came on. I'm thinking, all these people have come to help Joe Brown celebrate. It's amazing. Yeah. In the interval, one of my clients, the client I was sat next to, leaned back in his chair like this and looked at the sound domes of at the top of the Albert Hall and said, God, I'd love to play this place. And it was that conversation when I said, what do you mean? And he said, had a band, like so many of them. I was in a band at uni. When I left, work, kids all came along. Either they kept it up or they're relearning. But he explained that his firm had a band, and I went home from that gig on the tube because I lived in Richmond at the time, and sort of registered the word. I thought of the words "law rocks" and then registered it so no one else could choose it with and without the exclamation mark, and I went off to try and find some other bands and then a venue. Venue was the hardest. I managed to get six bands. Marcus Tavener Casey, who I knew played the guitar, I went up to him and explained what I was doing, and he said, you'll never do it, but if you do, I'll play.
Well, yeah, that's a good challenge, yeah.
Marcus has tread the board, he's trod the boards at the 100 Club several times. He played in Rome. I can't remember it, but he's played a few. He's hung up his guitar Law Rocks wise now. But yeah, he must have played the 100 Club 5-6 times. How many people can say that? The venue, finding the venue was interesting because I didn't know anything about live music. I didn't know what a backline was. I didn't know what monitors were. I didn't know what you needed to have to put on a live gig other than a band. I looked at all the options in London, not knowing what a good live music venue was for the needs that I had. Mm-hmm. And lots of people said, yes, you know, we'd love to host you. And I explained what I wanted to do, and it was all for charity, etc. But that'll be £8,000. Yeah, that wasn't what I was thinking of, you know, actually paying for it.
Yeah,
free. And when I eventually met Jeff Horton, the owner of the 100 Club, officially the most important live music venue in the world, as defined by the professor of music at Liverpool University, there's been live music in that room every week since the last day of the Second World War.
Wow.
Paul McCartney's piano still sits on the stage because can't be bothered to take it out, I suppose. Oasis, Blur. I mean, the Sex Pistols. You name it, they've all played there.
Played.
And he agreed to waive higher fees. I keep the door, he keeps the bar. And for many years. Oh, that as a venue struggled hugely through COVID. If it wasn't for the government making a bit of a U-turn on it, so many of those venues would have closed. He has been a really, really, he's been so important in the journey because he took that huge worry away from me. And then my dear friend, Ted Scott, absolutely one of my best friends in the world. I did the first year on my own. I bought Damien Hickman, or Charlie as we all know him from the IDRC, in, I think, in year two or three. And Ted came to a gig in year two or three and we got drunk, which was quite unusual, actually. And he said, why don't we do it in LA? So we did. And before you know it, we sold out the Whiskey Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard. There's six bands playing. And it was one of the most surreal nights of my life. And then what Ted has done in the US, along with his team, with Omi and Chloe and Amy, and whoever else I forgot to mention, I apologize. They have grown that to a very, very slick machine, and it raises so much money, aided by the fact that there is no benefit corporately for charitable giving in this country, but there is in the United States, and long may that last.
And I've been to some of the events, and I love the contrast. So I can remember being in Seoul, in indoor, and you know the difference, and then in
Miami,
yeah. Outside, and that was amazing, so cool. And there were, you know, oh, we have to finish a certain time because of the noise. But being an outdoor venue, especially, I mean, if you're American or Australian or from a hot country, you know, it must be more common. But for us Brits, outside concert, the band's there, and it was just, what a night! And it was such a celebration of music, and that's what I like, the fact that you've got, these are all people connected with law firms or consultancies, whatever, but law firms and barristers. And they dress up in various degrees in their sort of character for their group. They sing and they all have varying degrees of skill. I mean, some are amazing, some are, you know, pretty good. Oh, you know, I can't even play a comb. But then you're chatting to them and they're just like, and you're having a drink. And some of these bands are performing, and all they've managed to be able to do is they've practiced virtually online, some of them, because they're split in different offices. And they've turned up and they've had half an hour. And you would never know it.
I think, so one of the benefits of it, and you will know this, lawyers don't do things by halves. There is no way that any of those bands, particularly now, it was a bit more relaxed back in the day. But now here we are, what are we? It's year 16, maybe, where the standard is so high
that
people absolutely get it right. I mean, Akin Chambers won our gig at Scala a few weeks ago. And A, no one expected that. B, they won at their first outing, which is obviously in the first few years happened quite a lot. Not so much anymore. The sort of connectivity they had with the crowd, because they, I don't know if you noticed, they all smiled. They smiled and they looked at the crowd, they engaged, whereas quite a few bands or members of bands are focusing so much on not getting it wrong that they forget to smile.
Yeah, because but it's not their day job. That's the point, isn't it?
True.
They're trying so hard. It's not their day job, and they want to play brilliantly. You know,
we are giving them the chance to live the dream.
Yeah.
And the best bit about it is when everyone goes home, we get to give a charity a load of money. It's, you know, it's wonderful. Everyone wins.
Yeah. So if you take your golf scenario, so do you play any instrument then?
I used to play the piano. If my mother's listening to this, she will say, "What?" Well, still should, Nicholas. my brother kept it up. I did not, because I discovered BMX and girls. So they sort of...
Not necessarily in that order.
Yeah.
You never tempted to go back to the piano?
Me and quite a few Law Rocks drummers have discussed maybe me learning the drums. Apparently it's quite easy. But I just think drummers are my heroes. If you look at the level of communication between a band and its members, it's often the bass player, but most likely the drummer that is at the point of the triangle that is supporting that.
So band. Do you have a room in Bishopsgate that you could put drums and you'd be able to practice?
Not without being beaten up by all my colleagues, no. but I don't need to. We've got too many drummers. So the short answer is no. I can't play anything.
Can't play.
But I don't wish to. I'm surrounded by wonderful musicians who can do it.
I was going to say, and what about you over the next, you know, what are you planning over the next couple of years now with continuing to grow Law Rocks, Kids Out?
Yeah,
you're not going to form another charity?
I've lost the opportunity to go back into full-time modelling. So I think I need to sort of...
Never too late, you know. You've got lovely hair now.
This is a protest towards Louisa, my youngest daughter, who said, who dared to say it looks stupid. And until she says it looks nice, it's not getting cut. But she's a very strong-willed young lady.
Yeah, I have a daughter like that. I think your hair could be quite long, mate.
Yeah,
it could be quite long. Well, we could talk about Law Bakes. I think that's the next thing.
We could. But just to answer your question, we are in discussions with we're doing Law Rocks BVI next year. We're looking at doing Law Rocks Lagos next year. We're looking at Warsaw. We are in discussions with these cities. One of my favourite gigs every year is the Paris Arbitration Week gig, because those guys are just so brilliant and so warm, and the venue is just world class. Kids Out, yes, obviously still growing that. Joe Lemon Foundation, we've got an event later this year. I think I'm right in saying we have funded 4 young ladies to study law at Oxford. And when I say funded, I mean from start to finish.
Which again is a huge everything. Amount of money, and such a game change for those for those women and their families.
But the law needs more real people. When I started, I remember in my first chambers, there was a member of chambers who was a member of chambers because his dad was a member of chambers before him. So yeah, why not? Obviously, that's all changed now. But I do have 2 particular itches to scratch. One is I am planning, and it's taking its time. I'm a patron, along with my mother and my brother, of the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, which is one of the world's best orchestras.
Yeah.
And I want to do a black tie gig, maybe at Festival on the South Bank. It'll be fairly expensive ahead, but it will be all those songs that have orchestral manoeuvres in them. And if you think that you know quite a few of them, there are literally hundreds. You think of anything done even by Chic, they have strings in the background. The Welsh fellas, I can't remember their name now. Oh, the Manic Street Preachers.
Okay.
So many. So Natasha and I spent weeks going through the 9 days of music on my iTunes, just trying
just to decide,
which was lumpy, but we do a new chapter every car journey. And oh yeah, about this one, how about that one? Madness. The song? It Must Be Love. It's full of strings.
Yeah. But
when you hear it done live, the strings are more prominent. And I think that strings just give everyone they're really interestingly emotive. So that takes a lot of planning, because the orchestra will have to practice over here. The Law Rocks musicians will have to practice over here. We will come together for one day and one day only in the IDRC. So we will have to effectively amp that up for the day. And everything has to be note perfect, because if they're practicing it separately, there's no room for interpretation.
No.
It's got to be done as
exactly,
it was recorded.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's one. And then I have another not-for-profit that I've spoken to the Royal Foundation about. It's designed to help retrain and give confidence back to those people that have left our armed forces struggled to find employment. As you know, I spent some time in, I was very fortunate to have a house in the US for a long time. When you leave the armed forces in the US, you go up a level in society. It appears so that in this country, you go down a level in society.
Go down. Yeah, I
and
think that's true.
If these people are willing to wake up every day knowing that they might have to put their lives before ours, that's quite special.
Yeah. Oh, well, I wholeheartedly support both of those. You can obviously. Well, anything you do, you can help. You can sign me up to help you. That's a standard. But it demonstrates that you lack no energy or passion. And I think that's such a lovely thing in people that that's what I'd encourage other people to have is never let your passions dwindle, you know, because being really passionate, and it's an overused word, but being incredibly enthusiastic, let's say that, and always looking and thinking, well, actually, I've done that, and but why stop? Why not look for something else? And I think I see too many people who they're sort of ambitious, their ambition dwindles, and I think that's a very sad thing.
I mean, look, we all have our own personal mountains to climb, and we never know which mountain those people around us are currently climbing are going to climb in the next few years. But I think there is, you know, if half the population of the world, no, let's say a quarter of the population of the world, did just one thing, it's not the fact that they are doing one thing. So we do a lot as a firm, encouraging people to go and spend a day a year at a charity of their choice. It's not the fact that that person is doing that. It's more everyone that they know, all their friends, everyone they know, their entire network knows that they did it. And if they can spark one idea in another person. Yeah, I got the idea for the not-for-profit from watching a documentary on Channel 4 about a guy who left the armed forces having lost his lower leg on one side. Went through 1,000 job interviews, didn't get a job. And they got him a job on one of those lawyers that sucks the leaves out of drains.
Yeah.
This is a highly qualified engineer.
Yeah, it's opening up people's eyes to different perspective, and it's getting people not to have that linear view of life that's just from their perspective. And you're quite right. If more people just smiled and said hello, I'm a terrible person. My family are deeply embarrassed by my inability not to just smile and say hello or talk to anybody. Everywhere we go, the family are like,
But it's lovely. You see people smile.
You find a connection.
One of the things, as you know, Natasha and I sort of lecture an awful lot on body language and networking. People like positive people, and the easiest way to promote positivity is to smile.
Yeah.
You smile, and we do it in these sessions with various teams from law firms around the world. And we say, oh, yeah, I'm smiling now, and now you're smiling. And you smile at someone, and they smile.
But have you seen, you
must
have
seen. That's how it
worked. You know, when you say to someone, smile, and they're like, I was. Like, no, I'm go on, smile, and people go, and you can see, like, and say, do you know, it's what, 17 muscles to smile and 24 to frown. Yeah, it actually takes less energy. If you smile, you're saving energy. So if you're just lazy, smile.
You know? I am happily, naturally lazy, so I'll do more of that.
Nick, it's God, I mean, it's more than a pleasure to be able to talk to you. You're a truly, truly lovely bloke. You are inspiring. You're kind and generous. And I would struggle to find somebody who is as popular across the whole of the industry and across many, many countries that I go to. I know I can mention your name and they go, different types of knowledge. It might be from Law Rocks or something else or work, but everybody, it puts a smile on their face, and that says a huge.
That's
huge
very kind. Amount. That's very
so
kind of you.
And thank you so much for giving up your time.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for today's Barton Legal podcast. Please make sure you follow the show in your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be tackling another important topic in this month's Barton Legal webinar, and you can register for free and watch back our previous webinars at bartonlegal.com. Why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn and follow Barton Legal to keep up to date with all the legal trends and news? I look forward to speaking to you again in the next Barton Legal podcast.